welcome to Northern Latitudes. I'm Bill Ault. In this episode, we celebrate University Press Week, happening November 11th to the 15th. The Association of University Presses has announced a collection of 123 books and journals that embody the step-up theme of this year's celebration. The featured publications, curated by AU Press's members in 14 countries, present thought-provoking concepts, new points of view, inspiring ideas, many of which advocate for social change. One of those thought-provoking books, The Green Ages, Medieval Innovations in Sustainability, by Dr. Annette Kainal, the Chair of Medieval History at the University of Mannheim in Germany. Dr. Kainal joined me from Malawi for both a look back and forward at sustainability practices.
Hello, my name is Annette Kainal. I'm a professor for medieval history at the University of Mannheim, and I'm interested in the many aspects of our cultural heritage, doing historical anthropology, also lots of economic research on the relation between economics and culture. At the moment, I'm in Malawi for a research exchange because I'm very fond of interdisciplinary research, and I'm working together with paleoanthropologists, and I love research in the longue durée. That's actually what I'm really very interested in, you know, getting people to take on long-term perspectives. I think we have been stuck in short-term perspective thinking, and I think we need to get back to more intergenerational talks and thinkings and frameworks in our heads.
And your book is called The Green Ages, and it relates, or it speaks about and to how practices from many hundreds of years ago now could be used today. How did you get from being interested in medieval history to relating it to today's problems with the environment?
Well, the thing is, you know, working at my university, you naturally have to do with students all the time. And they are the ones who we sort of trying to get ready for their future, and their future will be a future on a much warmer globe than ours. So me as a historian, you know, I'm not an engineer. I cannot invent carbon capture mechanisms or technologies to contribute to you know, somehow get round with the challenges we have to face. But what I can do is sort of think about, or make people think about the sort of narratives in our heads. And one of the narratives most of us have sort of subconsciously in our heads is really, you know, once upon a time we used to be poor, and then came capitalism, and then we got all rich, and then the world was good. And as a pre-modern historian, as a medieval historian, I think we should question that narrative very much, because it's one of the hindrances in our head to think sort of about potential alternatives for the future. I call it the myth of no alternatives, because nobody, of course, wants to fall back into the Middle Ages. Mind you, myself as well, I don't want to go back to the Middle Ages. I want to say that very clearly right at the beginning of our interview and of our talk, Bill, because it's not about imitating the past. It's rather about broadening the horizon and really getting ideas and inspiration and especially motivation that what is can also be different without sort of the fear of then falling back to a state that nobody wants to live in.
And very right off the start, in the introduction of the book, you talk about our framework, the framework of how we think about things has become very much formed over the last couple of hundred years. And by that, do you mean that we've forgotten stuff from previous that could help us now?
Well, I think we should just, long-term thinking is a good thing. And what we all did in the last sort of maybe 50 years is short-term thinking, constant training in short-term revenues, the sort of just one more quarterly hit thinking, which you have to do once you work in a company or do finances and also get results, you know. But that has ruined the planet. And I think we need incentives for grandchildren-friendly behavior, if you want to call it like that. And I think, you know, our ancestors were certainly no better than us, but they were also not worse than us. And I want to try and show that they at least somehow managed not to destroy our beautiful planet. And that, after all, is the one and only home we have. So there must be something they got right in contrast to us.
One of the things I think people would say is that in medieval times, they did a lot of the things, especially sustainability practices, etc., because they had to. Have we reached that point again now where we have to because we have messed up a little bit in the last little while?
Well, yeah, that might be one thing. I mean, take, for example, recycling and repair. That's something we actually forgot a lot about because it's much cheaper to buy new things than actually to repair something or to recycle. Recycling is expensive. But if you look at history, you don't need to go back to the Middle Ages. It's enough if you go back the last maybe generation or two, because our grandparents were used to sort of live with what they have. And I would say they didn't live miserable because of that, you know. Right. It's quite the other way around. We seem to suffer by an overload of things, this universe of things that all surround us. And then if you look at the historical development, you can see that it was only after World War II when the markets were flooded with cheap oil, cheap fossil energies. So all the products you produced from that became cheap. And that was the beginning of the throwaway society. That was the beginning of the really sort of consumer society. Frank Trentman is one of the big historians who's really worked that out very well. The 50s sin of making throwaway the norm. And I think if we realize that it's not, you know, it's only recently that we actually developed this throwaway mentality, there might be a better chance that we can change it in the next 10 years or so than if we think, oh, humans had always, you know, ever since the Stone Age, they have been throwing away everything. That's not true. We have had a long history of 100,000 years, and we lived good lives in these times, you know, and could really, it would just be so arrogant to think that all the people who lived before us had poor lives because they knew recycling and repair, or they had to do it. I have a few examples in my book. I mean, take, for example, I'm talking about the beauty of recycling. So if you add age to some objects, you know, it's actually adding value. So take the throne of Charlemagne in Aachen. I mean, it's a totally a setup of recycled stone and marble taken from Jerusalem to Italy and then to Germany. And you see they had all sort of board games, little scribbles and graffiti on it. So it was really used stone. Some of the researchers have now the theory that it was actually the plates of a table in a saloon, in a playing saloon, because there you have this sort of grid of a game. I think you call it Nine Morris grid or something. But anyway, and this, they use this for something as valuable as a throne of the then supposedly most powerful ruler in Europe. So why do they do this? Because they want to add the value of a glorified past, you know, the Roman emperors, and then also the place where Christ was living, and so on and so forth. And they use it to add it. And the principle is the same as, you know, when today we buy a very expensive Jill Sanders jacket or something, it's the age that adds value. And I think this is one of the perspectives we can sort of remind us ourselves about or of.
Yeah, and it's funny, you mentioned grandparents, and I think back to my own grandparents and how we would call it frugal now, but I mean, they were just so much more in tune with the long use of things and, you know, the sustainability, like canning food and all that stuff that kind of disappeared within a couple of generations. I mean, it's...
It's kind of coming back. And also, maybe we can also add here the problem, you know, one of the problems with hindsight bias is that you always have the present as the measure for the past. And so we think our grandparents might have been poor because they didn't have, you know, the luxuries we have. But then I just, I keep telling the people, you know, if I'm, I mean, from the point of view of my children, I had a really deprived childhood. Why? Because I didn't have a mobile phone. But that's exactly sort of the logic, you understand. It's sort of the hindsight bias, and you make your own sort of condition a measure for what used to be in the old age. So that people were poor because they didn't have mobile phones. Yeah.
What, you didn't have Wi-Fi? Come on. What kind of time did you grow up in?
How did I survive? You know, I keep saying, how did humanity survive Stone Age without Google Maps or...
going back in time, and again, a little bit of this is started to come around again. But tell me what medieval farmers could teach us.
There is one thing I found really very interesting when I did my research for the book, that you had much more common farming and common ownership in medieval communities than today. So privatized land was, I mean, of course, that there it was there, but also you had communal farming for forests, but also for land and also for lakes. So if you take the forests, you can see that these communities, they took nearly everything from the forest. They took not only the wood for, you know, making fire and cooking, but also the trees for the leaves of the trees for keeping themselves warm and making their beds. And also they used the forests for farming their animals, make them grazing there. And they took food out, berries and mushrooms and whatever. So the forests were an extremely important resource for people at the time. And now is the question, how did they manage to sort of to live from it without destroying this resource. And then if you look at it, you see they have really very clearly defined rules of using the forest. You could not just go there and, you know, take what you wanted, but it was all regulated within the communities of the villages that belonged to the sort of user community, if you want. And you can see that they worked the forest so that it would regenerate. It would have time to regenerate every so often. And this needs a long-term perspective because, of course, these farmers were interested in leaving the forests in a, you know, state that would be useful for their own children and grandchildren as well. So you have a very careful management of the resource forest. And another example would be lakes, fishing. Again, you know, you wonder, how did these people, I mean, it was not, you could not own a lake privately. So you had a whole community of fishermen and fisherwomen. Take, for example, the Lake of Constance, which is one of the biggest lakes in Germany. And they worked and used and managed this lake as a resource, as a common resource, over half a millennium. Now the question is, how did they do this? And the secret or the answer is really very simple. Again, they had rules how to manage this resource. They met once a year in fishing, what so-called Fischertage, and they sort of looked, you know, what's the situation in the lake? What is the climate? What is the weather? Where many fish, or are there too little fish or too many? Which sorts are getting sort of a bit rusty? And then they would decide, okay, there are too little, take for example, little sightling or one sort of fish. And then they would say, okay, we make the size of our meshes bigger so the fish can go through. And that means actually they would sort of take into account or make clear we have less income this year, but then we will have more the next year. So in economic terms today, we talk about the internalization of externalities, you know, but that's what they did. And then they had the rules and then they stick to them. And if someone didn't stick to them, he was really punished. I mean, there were rules for punishment, and the ultimate punishment was actually he was kicked out of the community and had to leave it. But so the secret of the successful communal farming or managing the resource water lake was really communication. And that actually agrees with what Eleanor Ostrom, the Nobel Prize winner of 2008, found out when she did her research. She's an economist and she worked on the management of the commons and found the same true for today's commons. So I think that's a good, you know, you can just say, listen, people, human Homo sapiens is not that stupid. You know, Homo sapiens can do long-term thinking. And I think that's what I mean by changing our framework or mindset. Just have a bit more trust in our species. Yes, we can more than just destroy resources we are using. We can actually take care of them and make sure we can use them in a way that our children and grandchildren can use them as well.
Wow. I had no idea that there was that kind of planning for usage back in those days. Well, what else would surprise me? I mean, that really surprised me. I didn't expect that at all. Like when you started talking about them adjusting the size of the mesh in the net, I would never in, 500 or 700 years thought that they were doing that. Wow.
Yes. Well, that's a very good example for just ecological and also economical sustainability. You know, if you take three layers, you can have ecological sustainability, economical sustainability, and social sustainability. So the way, for example, farmers in the south of France used the mountains as common ground for grazing for their animals would be another example. And there again, you see, it was all strictly regulated. These people lived up in the mountains in the Pyrenees. And then over the summer, they took their animals down to the north where it was colder, the Catalonian side, the Spanish side, the North Spanish side, you know. And so there it was colder and more green. And then for the winter, they came back to the south of France. And again, you think we call this transhumans, which is a special sort of doing farming in a nomadic lifestyle. And this worked again over centuries because, again, there were clear rules. How many animals can you take up there? How many farmers are allowed to use this nomadic lifestyle? And then you would just have these agreements under the shepherds who lived that way and farmed their house, their animals. And also, if you would be grazing your animals on ground that is not allowed, you would get kicked out again, you know, so you had to pay a fine. So it was all very clearly defined. It is possible there as well that you can sort of use common resources without destroying them. Pierre Maury is actually the one who we know all about it, because this is one of these shepherds who lived there, and in the early 14th century in Montaillou, that's the village where many of these nomadic shepherds lived, there was a big Inquisition. And all these people had to talk to the bishop because they were supposed to be heretics. But they in the course of the Inquisition sort of protocols, you learn such a lot about their lifestyle and about the way they sell their animals and they sell their cheese and their milk and so on and so forth. And you realize it's all, you know, well organized, and they have clear regulations how much to produce, for example, or also price talks about, you know, not to sell too expensive and so on and so forth. So it's just another example how good humans are at organizing themselves to make sure they don't destroy their resources. And by the way, it came only with privatization and overuse of all these lands in the 18th century, when the whole world thought, you know, we need to get more efficient and more get more out of the resources we actually have. Then these forms of communal management of resources began to decline and was finally abolished. Most of it was really privatized.
And part of that, you talk in the book about how religion was a big part of the medieval attitude towards things. And as we've become more secular, starting back, I would say, around the 1800s, as it started to kind of divert, has that played a role in as well in how we haven't done as well at upkeeping things?
Well, the thing is, you know, there are good reasons why we tried to get rid of religion. We can see that today. I mean, religion is actually one of the things that causes an awful amount of wars and tensions and everything. I therefore try to avoid the term religion because it makes things so complicated. I think what we are actually talking about when we mean religion, say in the Middle Ages, we are talking about cultural sets of rules. You know, we tend to call them religious rules. But, you know, there were many things that are very sensible. So, I mean, it was a good thing that in the Age of Enlightenment, so we tried to overcome all the sort of suppression of the church and get a more freer world and everything. But at the same time, of course, we lost a sort of knowledge about cultural frameworks and cultural rituals and cultural settings that made people sort of agree that, you know, we can do everything and we can do really a lot, but maybe not everything is a good idea. So that's what I think was clearly more defined and more present in pre-modern times. People knew, you know, yes, we can do a lot and we can do, let's be whatever we can be. But then you always had this better not, because of course humans can be everything. I mean, they can be, you know, we can fly to the moon, we can be self-realization up to getting, now flying to the Mars or to Mars or whatever. But then we can also be, I mean, humans can also be mass murderers. Humans can also be inventing concentration camps, and they can also be destructive to a degree that is just stupid. I mean, we're the only species that seems to manage to destroy its own home, its own planet. So I think we have to reset and also to rethink the idea that let's be whatever we can. It's just a very dangerous concept. We need to remind ourselves that humans can be more than just genius people who manage so much. I mean, there is the dark side to human behavior, and we need to take that one into account. And now in the pre-modern times, that's what was mostly solved with religious rules. And the question is whether we manage to sort of solve this now again with rules they are not clad in religious speech, yeah, or language.
Would you call it more communal or community-minded rules that we've, as community has not dissolved, but certainly it's not what it once was. I mean, it doesn't matter how you frame it. It's just we don't have this kind of community approach that we had even when I was younger, and I'm not that old. But is that part of it? Is it part of it is that we've lost those rules that were in place kind of in the framework of religion, and now we don't have those rules because that's missing, but also because we've allowed community to kind of dissolve a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe the price we have to pay for individualism, because of course we all value and enjoy the amount of freedom we have as individuals. But at the same time, of course, community knowledge is on high demand now, because I mean, that's what I see with my students and also my children. You know, they would always have a much more critical way to think about the sort of general rules of my generation or whatever. So they are much more community orientated, I have the impression, many of them, not all, but many of them. And I wonder, I mean, they would freely and readily have, you know, exchange clothes amongst each other. That's one of the example I have in the book as well. You know, sharing is a very a way to live communities that makes you not only happy, but also, yeah, you can, you know, it's a working way, a model to live in sharing communities and exchange what you have for the use of others. So in monastic communities in the Middle Ages, you would have even, they would have what we call sort of deep, they share their clothes and have Kleiderkreisel, it's in German, Depop, I think it's in English or in England, I'm not quite sure, but you would, you know, not buy steadily new things, but just use them for a while and then give them on and hand them on and so. And that's just a wonderful thing, but it doesn't agree with maybe the way we have been thinking about, for example, clothes as a status symbol or whatever, or also in a consumer society, you always need something new. And this, of course, is on the one hand a personal need. I also like having new dresses or whatever. But on the other hand, it's obviously a business model. I mean, if you as a company offer T-shirts for 50 cents, I mean, you know, that's just, it's a new T-shirt, but or it's new, some sweater or whatever. But at the same time, it's just a total waste of resources. And it makes me sort of confident for the future that my students, many of them just refuse this tradition, this culture of sort of fast fashion and throwaway fashion. So again, here you have the impression, okay, maybe the next generation is really a step further on than we are. You're right, it is about community. And then, of course, we have to admit that sometimes, you know, I'm not sure in which sort of neighborhood you live, but it sometimes is very good if you have a neighbor who watches that, you know, nobody is coming or breaking into your house or whatever. But sometimes it's really a bit of a bore to have a neighbor who sees when you leave the house and who you take in or what you bought or whatever. So this social control, of course, is two-sided. But it is the price, I think, we have to pay for, yeah, sharing and living in communities and also enjoying all the benefits of communal life much more again. We could also talk about Beguins, these cities of ladies in the late 13th century. I mean, that's another example if you want. Again, you know, all the examples I collect in my book are really interestingly mostly models of life or concepts of managing resources that belong to phases in history where you have economic growth and where people are well off, which is very interesting. So in the late 13th century, you have the beginning of what we call sort of commercial revolution of the Middle Ages. And this spans down to early 16th century. And the well-off cities in Europe, in Flanders, so what is today Belgium and the Netherlands, they have growing industries, they have growing populations, and they have really lots of wealth. But at the same time, you see that in these cities, a new form of living together develops. Quarters, city quarters built where you have everything from, you know, streets, houses, churches, to mills, breweries, bakeries, and so on and so forth. But they are exclusively confined to women. And they are built with sort of capital donated or given by women very often. Isabella of Flanders, she was one of the big sponsors, and they would sort of provide space where women build their houses and can live. And it's usually working women, people who work, some of them in the textile industry, others would work in the health sector, some of them in what we call today sort of, you know, accompanying people before dying. But also you have really rich widows who build their houses within these quarters and live there with their, you know, they would have people who help them and serve them and everything. So it's a mix of diverse lifestyles, but at the same time, they all live in one part of the city and share lifetime, and they share space in a sheltered way. And this is a very interesting sort of, we call it an urban or topography, a new sort of urban landscape that developed in the late 13th century. And if you go to Flanders today, many of the cities, Bruges or Antwerp or Ghent, they have these beguinages down to today, which is very interesting because they give us sort of now what we call urban gardening space, and they make the cities really very beautiful. So again, you have a lot of, over centuries, a sort of model of living that changed over the centuries and all the time, but at the same time, it preserved more space within the cities, so we profit from them down to today. Yeah.
If you had one thing from the medieval period that you could say, hey, this, we need to do this, or this is something we should be doing for certain, what would it be?
I would say we should stop shopping so much.
Hey.
Because that's one thing, you know, I'm actually, in one part of the book, I'm trying to give a, you know, what would our ancestors tell us, or what would they say if they would hear about our problems and the challenges we face in the 21st century? And I'm pretty sure they would be really a bit worried and stressed if they see how much we must shop all the time. I mean, online shopping, but also on-site shopping or whatever. They would just say, you know, why don't you just use what you have? Why don't you give yourself more space? Leave your cellars empty, leave your flats emptier, and give you yourself more space. Because if you have so many things, it's always it's a burden. Owning a lot of things is a burden. And I think it's one of the things we should, yeah, that's what I would say. Stop shopping so much. It's really a waste of time and also a waste of resources apart from that.
The book is called The Green Ages, from Brandeis University Press. Dr. Annette Cannell has been my guest, and it's been a lovely chat. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks to Dr. Annette Cannell for joining us, and to Leanne Caring of Sharp Pencil Marketing for putting us in touch with one another. For more information about University Press Week and Dr. Cannell, check out the show notes. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite listening platform to stay up to date with all our projects. For even more Northern Latitudes content, including all the previous podcast episodes, my photography, and Northern Latitude events, go to northernlatitudes.ca. Theme music and sound logo produced by John Sanfilippo of Soundwise. To leave a comment or suggest a guest, email me at podcast@northernlatitudes.ca. Until next time, I'm Bill Ault. Find your way to Northern Latitudes.
Thank you.